regulation after regulation and tax.
There are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
185,000 pages.
Without public accountability and transparency, there will be no public support.
Is this really the best we can do?
If there's a regulation that doesn't make any sense, why do you keep...
Do you know who wrote the regulatory laws you must comply with?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
On June 7th, 2022, the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project hosted a virtual event via Twitter Spaces on occupational licensing. The following is the audio from that event. We hope you enjoy.
Alrighty, I believe we can get underway. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Regulatory Transparency Project Twitter Space. My name is Jack Derwin, and I'm Associate Director of RTP at the Federalist Society. We're very excited to host what I'm sure will be a fantastic program today on occupational licensing. We'll have remarks from Utah Governor Spencer Cox, followed by an expert panel discussion. Our host today, Shoshana Weissman, is Senior Manager of Digital Media and a fellow at R Street Institute. She has written for numerous publications, including the Wall Street Journal and USA Today, and her work focuses on the Supreme Court, social media regulation, and of course, today's topic, occupational licensing. With that, Shoshana, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you so much for hosting this event. I've loved being a member of the Federalist Society literally since I was 16 years old. I'm that big a nerd, so it's a real pleasure. And it's even more of a pleasure to get to introduce Governor Spencer Cox today. I have an intro that I think gets to a lot of good parts about him. So Governor Spencer Cox is a husband, father, farmer, recovering attorney, and Utah's 18th governor. He is a lifelong Utahn, aggressively civil, and might like Yuval Levin's A Time to Build more than I do. He started his political career as a city councilman and then did about just everything else before serving as lieutenant governor and now governor. And there's a few fun facts I wanted to share about the governor. His first executive order in his first hour as governor was on occupational licensing reform. And as much as you might think, it wasn't at my request. Utah is the best state. That's just another fun fact. Although on the downside, Cox had said prior to his being elected that he wanted to show that, quote, we would represent all of Utah, not just the Wasatch Front. I say this as a negative because the Wasatch is my favorite mountain range. So before I introduce our panel and before we get into the panel, I'm excited to have the opportunity for all of us to hear from Governor Cox about my favorite topic, occupational licensing reform. Thank you. It looks like there's a little trouble getting the governor to be added as a speaker. So while we do that, and while I wait for him to have the little speaker thing next to him, I'll also talk about the panel a little bit. So we're going to talk about occupational licensing reform pretty broadly. And you know, it's a big issue with a lot of sides. It affects military spouses, mobility generally for all different kinds of people. Some licenses maybe shouldn't exist, some should, and there can always be debate over it. But there's so many different sides to debate on, from criminal justice reform to the military spouse angle. But our three panelists all come from different angles. For example, is the Director of General Economics at Cato's Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies. He can clarify just about any economic issue, including this, for a reader of any level. Although, unfortunately, he's kind of unkind to the frogs in his yard. They're from Colin Mortimer, who not only shares most of a surname with a fictional turtle mayor in Animal Crossing, but he's also director of the Center for New Liberalism at the Progressive Policy Institute, which seeks to develop a salient identity around the center-left values that have increasingly come under fire in the age of populism. His work and influence is wide-reaching, bipartisan, and collaborative. And John Gabriel is the editor-in-chief of Ricochet and columnist at the Arizona Central. He wears many hats and lives in Arizona, presumably with some javelina. He is a political writer and a marketing consultant. Until 2012, he was director of marketing at the for the Goldwater Institute. And until 2012, he was director of and he once also led marketing efforts for Cold Stone Creamery. And now that I just finished that, it's perfect time, and it looks like the governor is a speaker, so I'm going to hand it off to him.
Well, Shoshana, I hope you can hear me. I'm so sorry that we had some technical difficulties, but I think we finally made it work. I am so excited to be here with you this morning. I appreciate that incredibly kind introduction from the good senator from East Virginia, one of my favorite people, and we've certainly had lots of fun discussions around so many issues, but especially occupational licensing. My love affair with occupational license actually started about a decade ago when I was serving as a county commissioner at the time. But the state of Utah had been sued by somebody who was braiding hair for a living, and we had some very onerous occupational licensing requirements for braiding hair. People had to go to basically a cosmetology school, over 2,000 hours of required training just to braid hair. Obviously, not just irresponsible, but certainly something worse. It felt like it was just completely harming the people who needed help the most, those at the margins, in a crazy protectionist scheme that had been set up, and it just lacked common sense. It was crazy to me that you needed less hours to actually fly an airplane than you needed to braid hair in the state of Utah. And so I was fortunate to get elected to the House of Representatives about that time, as that lawsuit was progressing and the state lost that lawsuit. I was lucky to serve as a freshman on our Business and Labor Committee, and we were able to push through legislation that changed those requirements significantly and made it much easier for people who wanted to braid hair for a living to actually do that without such significant state involvement. From that time on, I've tried to be very wary of occupational licensing requirements in our state. And as Shoshana mentioned, I was fortunate enough to be elected governor. And the very first thing that I did as governor was to require a review of all of the occupational licensing requirements in our state and to look for ways to change that. But I have to be honest that wasn't enough for me, because occupational licensing creep is a real thing. And we certainly see that even in states like mine, where we try very hard to watch out for those types of onerous and unnecessary requirements. They happen over time. Well-meaning legislators and others and some not so well-meaning, I think, industries who want to protect their turf continue to make it difficult every single year, more and more difficult for people to participate in our modern economy. And so we decided this year to do a couple things. First of all, it's important to mention that, like many states, our biggest problem right now, I guess, aside from inflation and actually to inflation, is a lack of people to participate in the incredible economic success that we're having. Utah has had the best economy in the nation for about the last 10 years. We have the lowest unemployment in the nation. We've had the highest GDP growth and the highest job growth. We were the first state out of the pandemic to replace the jobs lost during the pandemic. And together with Idaho, we have a significant lead on the rest of the nation when it comes to job growth. We're at about 4% above where we were in 2019 when the pandemic started. And so we just need more workers. And too often the occupational licensing requirements are making that part more difficult to fill those jobs. So we need more people. Second of all, I wanted to find a way to institutionalize the review of occupational licensing requirements, so it's not just dependent on a new governor coming in or you know, a group of legislators deciding it's time to review this or that occupation. We wanted to institutionalize a way to prevent that creep from happening. And so this past legislative session, with some great legislators, Senators Kurt Bramble and Joel Ferry and some others, we were able to do a couple great things. So some really landmark pieces of legislation. The first one was Senate 43, which creates a pathway for people trained in other countries, including refugees. And Utah has been very open to refugees for many years to obtain a license and allow these well-qualified individuals to fill in-demand jobs in our state and provide needed relief to our workforce shortage. So they are often trained, they're very talented, they've worked in other countries, and we've given a pathway for them to get the licenses they need to work here in the state of Utah. The second piece of this, as I mentioned, is Senate Bill 16, which passed this license reform bill to institutionalize these reviews. So basically, sometimes you have to create more government to get rid of more government, and that was the case here. But this was the idea behind this is that we would set up as part of our agency every 10 years at a minimum, we would review every single occupational licensing requirement, and any new occupational licensing requirement that any legislator wants to propose has to go through this department that would then review all of the requirements. And I won't go into those right now, but we have a long list of a report that we have to give back that comes out. We just hired the person that is going to run this office. They begin operations on July 1st. And I must admit, it's the very first kind of this office is the first of its kind in the country. Touches all state licensing, and so any proposal we get to, they have to go through this pretty onerous process. This is a way where we do want government to be very onerous, and that is in proposing new regulations to point out what the occupational and safety hazard really is, and how intense it is, and how this is going to affect the ability of people, especially those living at the margins, to be able to work in this space. So we want people to have to jump through every hoop. We want to make it as difficult as possible to propose new occupational licensing requirements and to keep old occupational licensing requirements. And we will then deliver those reports to the legislature to help them make better decisions as we're reviewing the old requirements or any new requirements that come on board. And our hope is that this will give pause to legislators as they're reviewing this. And only those that really do justify the types of requirements being proposed will actually pass the legislature. So that's just a little bit of a look into what we're doing here in Utah. Again, so excited for this panel and grateful for the work that is happening in this space. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Shoshana.
Thank you so much. And it's so exciting to see Utah lead here. I really expected Governor Cox to be, you know, to do a lot of this work, but I didn't expect it in his first hour of office, which was pretty cool. But part of what's valuable about his model is that it really does set up that process. And through my main job at the R Street Institute, we're a big advocate of growing government to shrink it sometimes. And this is a great example of that. So now I know I've already talked about our panel, and I'd like to start with with my first question, because everyone seems to have come to this issue in a very different way. So I'll start with Scott Lincecombe. Tell me how you got into occupational licensing reform, and was it my Twitter? Scott, are you there? Make sure to unmute yourself. If not, we can go to Don Gabriel. Tell me how you got into
occupational reform. I got it. I'm here. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Scott.
Sorry about that. Anyway, it was not your Twitter account, but I do tip my cap to you as being kind of an OG occupational licensing reform champion, for sure. My original interactions with occupational licensing reform were actually personal. I was a...
Thank you, Scott.
Sorry about that. Anyway, it was not your Twitter account, but I do tip my cap to you as being kind of an OG occupational licensing reform champion, for sure. My original interactions with occupational licensing reform were actually personal. I was an attorney at a law firm in Washington, D.C., toiling away, doing the big law thing. My wife got a job down here in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I now live, and we wanted to move. And the type of law I was doing, international trade law, was actually pretty easily done remotely. And so after getting approval from my firm to do this, we realized that the barriers for me to move just a mere 4 hours south, practicing international law, so not practicing North Carolina law or anything, were almost impenetrable. I had to get relicensed. We had to do all this tax stuff. I had to pay thousands of dollars in fees to transfer my bar license. I had to undertake dozens of hours of continuing legal education, costing hundreds of dollars per year. And I was, this was a pretty significant impediment to my own ability to move and start a family down here in North Carolina. And that struck me as ridiculous. Ridiculous, not only personally. Look, I was lucky. I was working for a large firm. They were graciously willing to subsidize all of this. But, you know, a lot of folks don't have a giant law firm backing them financially. A lot of folks, particularly, you know, lower income folks, military spouses, and the rest. encounter these barriers every day and struggle to surmount them, or maybe they can't at all. And so that really was my initial foray into realizing a lot of the absurdity and of occupational licensing and the desperate need for reform. But since then, as I've kind of continued my policy journey, I've realized the extent to which occupational licensing is a barrier for all sorts of the type of economic dynamism churn that we want to happen in a market economy. You know, there are all these disruptions out there arising from trade or automation or just natural change in consumer tastes. And then we have licensing, among other barriers, that really prevent individuals from moving to a better town, from starting a different job, from going out on their own and starting a business. And again, these disproportionately burden lower income folks or people with criminal record or, again, military spouses and the rest. And you see that, if you were to create kind of a top five list, I love top five lists of government imposed barriers to economic dynamism and innovation and growth, licensing would have to be near the top, but particularly given how, it has proliferated in recent years and to the point that it's covering, between about 25% of jobs. So that's my kind of initial journey in the space, and I'll pass it back to y'all.
For sure. I'll just jump in quick before I go to Colin. So it's funny because lawyer licensing reform has kind of become possible over the past few years, especially as the bar exam failed so miserably during the pandemic. I mean, I know it's vulgar, but like you had stories of people peeing in their seats because they were so afraid to be out of frame during the bar exam because it's recorded and you have to sit there and you can't look out of frame. So from that to the fact that, hey, lawyers are kind of the same everywhere, there's been a lot of thought there. There's logical pushback, too. But it's kind of opened up interest here in a way that it hadn't been before. So it's interesting that you came to it through there. And now there's kind of that opportunity now. I'm actually working on a paper on the subject. But Colin, tell me about how you got interested in it.
Thanks, Shoshana. And I really appreciate you including me in this panel. I love this issue because it's one of these issues that we really find bipartisan support for. I'd be remiss not to mention our friend Jared Polis, who has also done great work in the state of Colorado on occupational licensing reform. We came to this issue probably very early on in our organization. So we started in 2017. I'd say probably around then, if not 2018, we really started banging the drum of how insane it was that to be a hairdresser, you had to do all these hours of training. To be a florist, you had to do all these hours of training. And then, God forbid, you decided to move over state lines, you'd have to do that training again. And we just basically said, hey, this is bad economics. This is bad policy. This is anti-poor. This is anti-working class. And then COVID came around. And that really vindicated what we've been saying for years, because you had healthcare workers who had to go to different states wherever the pandemic was really popping up. And states were rushing to tear down these occupational licensing laws. It's kind of ironic that these states will say, oh, we need to license hairdressers because health and safety. But the second there's actually a pandemic and a healthcare crisis, they're like, oh, the people who are working on the front line of healthcare, they don't need occupational licensing. So it really makes clear and lays bare how these laws really are less designed to preserve safety and healthcare and more to basically provide a benefit to incumbents and people who've been in the field for longer and lock out people who are poor or can't afford the training. But then another thing happened, which is inflation and worker shortages. And that has also really laid bare of how desperately we need occupational licensing reform. You have shortages in so many different sectors, but especially sectors that have a lower barrier to entry or a working class or have lower wages. But states still have these laws in the book that make it so hard to get these jobs or move to a state where shortages are more acute. So every day, I feel like there's another example of why this issue is so important, and we'll continue to yell from the rooftops, mostly on deaf ears, about how important this is. But I do hope that the COVID pandemic and the subsequent inflation crisis and shortages really are waking up lawmakers and policymakers to how necessary reforms in this space are.
Absolutely. And also, it's funny, Florist is how I got into this. Clark Neely, who at the time was at the Institute for Justice, got me into this issue when I heard him speak about an elderly widow who only had one way to provide for herself because it's the only thing she knew, how to arrange flowers. And the government wouldn't let her do it. And she failed a licensing exam. And it's not because, you know, arranging flowers is particularly dangerous or complicated. I mean, you can do it poorly. You can do anything poorly, but it's not going to harm someone if they get bad flowers, I guess. But the ridiculousness of it, and that when she passed away, she was in poverty. That really, that was kind of the end of it for me. And I'm like, well, this is what I'm doing with the rest of my life. So it's funny. It's that same story that got me into it. Governor Cox, actually, if you're still around, I'd love for you to weigh in on how you got into the issue to begin with. If it was the, you know, if it was what you found in Utah, or if you had heard of it before, or as a lawyer, if that was part of it for you as well.
Sure, I appreciate that. So definitely my time as a lawyer, as I was looking at the landscape and you know, I studied in Virginia, came back to Utah to take the bar and had some questions, much like Scott, about how this all worked and whether it made sense. But to me, the shocking part was in the, as I mentioned, in the hair braiding space, when I started to see the crazy requirements that just didn't make sense. My own sister was going to a cosmetology school at the time, and her husband was studying to be a pilot, and they pointed out to me that she had more practice requirements than he did, and that just the absurdity of it all just made no sense to me. And then really focusing on the military families as well, as I had friends who were in the military and their spouses as they were traveling around the country, and whether they were teachers or you know, hairdressers or whatever it was. The absurdity of them not being able to do what they knew how to do and impacting those who are serving our country. It was just astonishing to me. And that's where I really decided to get involved.
Thank you so much. And I can't thank you enough for sticking around to talk with us more. And now, John, so we mentioned Governor Polis, who as well is awesome on occupational licensing reform. But John, you have a couple of connections to Governor Ducey. Coldstone. So was it the gov at Coldstone who got you interested in this, who's also great on this? Is it your, like, it's all the work you do? You've done so much and you've been all over, always very closely tied to Arizona, but you've done so much. So tell me how you came to this issue.
Yes, I'm definitely the layperson. I think I was asked to speak looking at the fine qualifications of the other speakers. I think I'm here as comic relief, perhaps. But I've always cared about this issue. And yes, I worked before I got into policy or writing about politics or anything like that. I was in the private sector, and I happened to work running a marketing wing of Coldstone Creamery, where Doug Ducey was the CEO. And I didn't know his politics or policy chops. He didn't know mine either. And years later, he was elected treasurer and then governor of Arizona. And I had kind of had it with the business environment and problems there. So I officially joined the Goldwater Institute as director of marketing there. So my job there was basically promoting what shockingly some people view as a dry issue, and make it more compelling, which was actually easy with occupational licensing because it affects so many people who are just trying to put food on their table these days, or just trying to fill their tank, and the government is standing in their way all too often. I first got really educated on the issue with the Goldwater Institute and helping promote that issue there. And then as well, later on, we had Governor Doug Ducey, who was really some of the first work that he did. It seems like the Western states have been fantastic on this issue. Governor Polis, Governor Cox in Utah. But just realizing that it doesn't matter what party you belong to, if any. It doesn't matter if you consider yourself left, right, or center. You're just trying to help people do some work and help out their neighbor, help out people in the community. And it really is. It's one of these issues that it's kind of shocking that people could even oppose reforming occupational licensing. But it's really good to see, especially from my vantage point, the Western states see people out there helping out because it's these interventions by government that's really regressive in its impact. It really affects people who don't have a lot of time for and money for education, cosmetology. The governor, Governor Cox had mentioned earlier, is a fine example of that. I can understand needing some training and some professionalism. On the other hand, here in Arizona, shortly before Governor Ducey was elected to office, you had someone who was working in Tucson, Arizona, cutting hair of homeless people to kind of make themselves look better, feel good, maybe get that first job interview on their road to full employment. And the state cosmetology board at the time was shutting that person down and threatening lawsuits against him and the like. So it's one of these issues. Governor Ducey stepped in and that was all reversed. He's been very aggressive on improving the environment for people working. If you have a certification, you have a license for another state in any area, really, Arizona will recognize it. It has boosted jobs here. Our economic record has been fantastic. And it's just it's a win for everybody. And it's good to see governors where, you know, you read the news about Washington, D.C. and nothing gets done. And the only legislation passed seems to be, you know, trillion plus dollar omnibus bills, maybe once a year. It's great to see governors, legislatures around the country just say, hey, here's something that the vast majority of us can agree on and we can actually help people and get government the heck out of their way so they can provide for their family and build a career for themselves.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm so glad to have you with us, especially because you come from a background similar to mine, where, you know, at the R Street Institute, I promote a lot of our work, but I'm not always the one doing it. And it kind of gives you a special vantage point where you can combine your understanding of communications with that of policy. And I think it gives you a kind of special place here. So for my next question, and it's open to any of you four who would like to take it, what do you think is next for licensing? Where do you think we can convince people towards our side? Are there people that we haven't engaged who we should be engaging in the same way that, you know, Governor Cox mentioned refugees, and I think that's a really important angle, but it's such a complex issue. So I'd be curious where you think there's opportunity next.
Shoshana, it's Scott. I can go ahead there.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, it seems to me the lowest hanging fruit here is some sort of mutual recognition or reciprocity system. You know, similar to what Arizona did and others that, you know, basically says, look, if you're licensed anywhere in the country, you're licensed here. I think that's the easiest because it doesn't deal with some of the thornier consumer welfare issues that come up with just simply repealing licensing altogether, which of course, you know, would be great, I think, in a lot of cases, but that's gonna be more difficult. By contrast, you know, just simply recognizing the licenses of other states and the competency of other licensing jurisdictions seems a lot easier. And I think it would achieve some of the goals that we want in terms of, you know, economic mobility, physical mobility, that kind of stuff. The other area that seems really ripe for reform is on the criminal justice side. You know, the really pernicious effects of certain licensing regimes on the ability of people with very minor criminal records going back a long time to enter a licensed profession really is a significant economic, social, and I think moral problem. And there would seem, I think, to given kind of recent criminal justice trends, there would seem to be another area that you can, you know, you need cross-pollination of sorts, right? That you can get criminal justice folks and labor market folks and licensing reform folks all on the same page and then maybe push something there in a bipartisan manner.
Definitely. I think universal licensing recognition has been a real winner, especially because it came, you know, the first instance of it was via Governor Ducey, literally months before the pandemic, where, you know, you already had a process in place to say, hey, if you're licensed here, you can be licensed here, which wasn't really a thing prior to, you know, it wasn't a thing prior to when he did that at all. Colin or John, do you have something to add? Would you like to talk about what you see as a next frontier, especially you, Colin, too, thinking about the left? I feel like it tends to be a right-leaning issue, not that it has to be at all. You know, Governor Polis has been a champion. Governor Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania has been really interested in this. But I wonder if you have more to say there from your neoliberal center-left perspective, or John, from your cold phone perspective. No, I'm kidding. From your wide vantage point, knowing a lot of different issues too, for whoever would like to take it.
Thanks, Shoshana. Yeah, I'll hop in just for a second. And first, just ditto basically everything Scott said, because he took the words out of my mouth. But I do want to add one thing, which is, I mean, I just keep beating this drum about inflation and the political liability that it poses, that if Democrats are looking for short-term fixes for inflation, especially addressing the labor shortages, like this is low-hanging fruit that could make an impact tomorrow. Inflation is a tricky issue. A lot of the fixes for it take a little while or hurt people. But just saying, hey, if you are someone who works in another state and you want to come work in our state, you're allowed to, and you don't have to get relicensed. You don't have to do these hours of training. And that's going to help inflationary pressures. So I think Democrats should be doing this today. They should have done it yesterday for other reasons, but especially considering that the biggest issue facing them in the upcoming elections is inflation, they should be really trying anything. And this is a really, really perfect policy for them to take on.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Especially, you know, there's, like you're saying, with inflation, there's a lot of different options, but there's a lot of cost to them as well, unfortunately. But yeah, this is a kind of like stress-free way to do it. And to his credit, President Joe Biden has expressed interest in this. President Barack Obama also had a big occupational licensing reform report kind of explaining how this could all work. And President Trump as well. So there's definitely interest, but not a ton of movement up there. And one more question for whoever would like to take it as well. What do you think is the best argument against licensing reform? Like, is there an argument where you hear it and you're like, maybe we shouldn't do this, or you know, I'm not with you, but I kind of get it. So be your own devil's advocate and tell me what you think the best argument against it is.
This is John Gabriel. It's really hard for me. Something I always try to do is, I don't know, if I'm making an article and writing an article about an opinion, I usually want to steel man that argument, not address the easy to knock down points of any opponents the issue might have, but basically take their best shot and use that as my challenge to convince that person. But it's really difficult to with this issue. Now, you can have occupational licensing for, I don't know, a neurosurgeon or something, or you can be in a situation where it's for a florist. So there's so many different layers to this and so many great ways to innovate on it, especially on the low-hanging fruit type things. And that's what you'll usually see places like the Goldwater Institute, when they're addressing this issue, they will focus on, you know, the cosmetology or the florist or some of these kind of low-level things where it just really hits people in the right versus wrong before you even get into policy arguments. It's like, oh, come on, this is an African hair braider who, you know, wants to help out our community. Why don't we let her do that? It's not that big a deal. But I can definitely understand. This is John Gabriel. It's really hard for me. Something I always try to do is, I don't know, if I'm making an article and writing an article about an opinion, I usually want to steel man that argument, not address the easy to knock down points of any opponents the issue might have, but basically take their best shot and use that as my challenge to convince that person. But it's really difficult to with this issue. Now, you can have occupational licensing for, I don't know, a neurosurgeon or something, or you can be in a situation where it's for a florist. So there's so many different layers to this and so many great ways to innovate on it, especially on the low-hanging fruit type things. And that's what you'll usually see places like the Goldwater Institute, when they're addressing this issue, they will focus on, you know, the cosmetology or the florist or some of these kind of low-level things where it just really hits people in the right versus wrong before you even get into policy arguments. It's like, oh, come on, this is an African hair braider who, you know, wants to help out our community. Why don't we let her do that? It's not that big a deal. But I can definitely understand safety issues and making sure that everything is addressed. Even in cosmetology, there are health and safety that you want to look out for. But it's a very easy issue for us to defend, and it's very difficult to challenge it without seeming like you're missing the point by not letting people get to work.
Yeah, it's Scott here. I would just add to what John was saying. I mean, I think the Steelman argument relates to informational asymmetries out there, right? That consumers lack the information needed to make wise choices about certain licensed professions. I think it's very difficult to make that argument for hair braiding or something, but certainly there are others where you can say that, it's difficult to divine the skills and competency of certain licensed individuals. Now, saying that, I have to add, I think they'd probably take away my libertarian card if I didn't, that look, that the arguments these days are severely diminished by the omnipresence of the internet. We all walk around with portable supercomputers attached to all knowledge ever created in the palm of our hands. It is extremely easy for people to get the information they need to make wise choices as consumers, and then of course there's all sorts of other traditional methods of doing that. But if I were to steelman the argument, I think that in certain professions where there is a potential safety issue, where there is a potential informational asymmetry, that's probably going to be your best argument. But it strikes me as pretty weak, except for a very small handful of occupations.
I will echo noted libertarian Gary Johnson during the Labour Party debate when he said that he'd like to see some basic competency from people behind the wheel on the road. I think basically the same thing applies to people who have people's lives in their hands, like pilots and doctors. But then really after that, I think the case for occupational licensing gets pretty flimsy.
What about this argument? How about when people are like, oh, well, it raises wages and you don't want people to be making low wages. And maybe this is a way around mandating a minimum wage for those who oppose it. Maybe this is how we increase wages. Or what about the argument that basically people of color who sometimes have trouble gaining appropriate credibility, just like anyone else, sometimes find that through licensing where people are likely to trust them more. Those are two arguments that I find people in good faith will often bring up saying, hey, well, what about this? Do you have a response to that?
Well, it's Scott here again. I mean, sure, being in the club is good for the club members, or can be potentially good for the club members. But that has to be balanced against all of the people trying to enter that club and prevented from doing so. This is, NIMBYism, protectionism, you name it, right? There, you're going to have concentrated benefits for a few winners, but diffuse costs for far more. Of course, the people on the outside also tend to be lower income, disadvantaged in some way. So you take that, kind of moral or ethical side, and you combine that with, I think, the broader economic problems of this type of protectionism, restricting mobility, restricting job growth, restricting innovation in the industry, restricting entrepreneurship, all those types of things that harm state economies and the national economy have to be weighed against, a potential wage bump for a protected member of the club, along with, again, all those moral and ethical issues as well.
Perfect. John or Colin, before I move on to the next one, feel free to jump in and interrupt me while I'm going to the next one too. But I think those tend to be the most arguments that I see in good faith. People who really want to do well for others, but maybe, I'm not sure I'd agree with it, but you can kind of get where they're coming from. What about, what do you think is next for licensing reform? Like, obviously we're seeing some movement with universal licensing recognition. Do you think the future, the smart way to proceed would be to try to get that in every state? Do you think there's other reforms that we should... Perfect. John or Colin, before I move on to the next one, feel free to jump in and interrupt me while I'm going to the next one too. But I think those tend to be the most arguments that I see in good faith. People who really want to do well for others, but maybe, I'm not sure I'd agree with it, but you can kind of get where they're coming from. What about, what do you think is next for licensing reform? Like, obviously we're seeing some movement with universal licensing recognition. Do you think the future, the smart way to proceed would be to try to get that in every state? Do you think there's other reforms that we should be thinking about, whether it be lawyers or doctors, not saying we de-license doctors, but like maybe we allow immigrants to work. And think about this too, in light of as Colin was saying, the labor shortage with inflation. Are there smart ways to go after this in light of other bigger problems, or even just other opportunities such as those created by the pandemic, where like people couldn't move for multiple hours during the bar exam or, things like that? Are there other things here that you think it would be like a prime time to
Yeah, I mean, I'll offer my thoughts very quickly. I, like I said earlier, I think universal licensing state by state is really probably the next step. You have a lot of governors who I think would be keen or inclined to adopt this. Governors tend to be a bit more rational and level-headed than the federal government. But I do think that certain areas that were really impacted by the pandemic really just have a good case from the public of being adopted. Healthcare, again, like just really jumps to mind because people really saw in their face just how bad healthcare shortages during the height of the pandemic were impacting people. There's no reason why a foreign educated doctor shouldn't be allowed to practice in the United States with minimal amount of additional training. And I think that's really the stuff that occupational licensing reform people should be banging the drum about. So I'm optimistic for the future. It looks like this is an issue that's moving in the right direction. And it's thanks to the work of people like you, Shoshana, Scott, and other really great think tanks for pushing this to the forefront.
Thank you. I would like to thank myself, too. No, I'm kidding. No, there's so much work that's been done, and I'm just thankful to be a part of it. Scott or John, do you have anything to add? Are there new groups we could be tapping here, too, for support, whether it's the NatCons or populists? Because it seems like some of them do have an interest in licensing reform. And especially with labor shortages, I think that might be, you know, a way to kind of poke them and be like, hey, here's an opportunity. But do either of you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, I can add a couple things. First, in terms of other low-hanging fruit, you know, the other area that seems to me to be a no-brainer or at least an easier lift is on some sort of, you know, independent review of licensing after a set period of time. You know, you have kind of a sunset where the license regime exists for a decade or whatever, and then is subject to a mandatory review by an independent panel to look at kind of costs and benefits. That again strikes me as easier than just simply, you know, repealing these things outright. It also provides more of a transition for folks in the protected class to realize that, you know, there might be a change and more competition coming soon. In terms of groups, well, look, you know, everybody is focused right now, whether it's NatCons or folks on the left and the right, you know, it's about, you know, pro-worker policies, even amidst the labor shortage, right? And, you know, occupational licensing, again, strikes me as a really important pro-worker reform in the sense of allowing individuals to enter occupations, you know, whether they've been disrupted again by trade or automation or whatever, able to change careers and better themselves or move to a better place. And so often, you know, in the current system, occupational licensing rules prevent that, or at least make it, you know, really difficult and costly. Pretty easy for a guy working for big law, not so easy for a sole proprietor or, you know, again, somebody in hair braiding or something like that. And so, you know, to the extent that these can be couched as pro-worker policies, then, you know, I think there is a potential attraction there.
Thank you. And yeah, before we move on to my next question too, since we have about 15 minutes left, if people have questions from the audience, feel free to like raise your hand thingy in this. But once I click on you, just so you know, you have to click accept. I guess it's like so that if you're doing something else random that's loud, it doesn't interrupt it. But yeah, feel free to chime in and ask questions. But John, I'd be curious, is this an issue that you see popping up a lot? Like, you know, you reach so many people. Do people like bug you about licensing reform a lot? Is it something that you've seen increasing in interest or decreasing in interest? So I'd like to hear about more how, you know, how much you hear about it, what people are most interested in when they reach out about it.
Yes, it definitely is coming up more. And I think a lot of that has to do with the shortage of labor that we have available throughout the country. Obviously, locally, it affects Sunbelt states because we have such a transient population. People are always moving in and moving out of Sunbelt states. And so a lot of people are very concerned about it, especially people new to Arizona. Move here from the Chicago area is a very popular starting place to flee, basically. That's what my family did when I was, 6 years old or so. But they're usually just thrilled that Arizona is so open about it. And if you have a certification in your home state, it's accepted here. And that's very positive for people. I think it is something that's coming up more and more because we just need to. This is just a great area for government just to get out of people's way and not in more of the fringe. When people look at the average Democrat or Republican who isn't that into policy, let's say, and they'll think libertarian and they'll say, okay, some of their ideas are a little far out there. But this really is something that unites everybody. I think both parties and independents, which I know in my own state and most of the country, if you want to consider independents a party, it's the fastest growing party, definitely out here, with almost a third of registered voters being independent. People are craving solutions that aren't about kind of oppose and own the libs or own the cons or things like that. We have real problems out here, and people just want solutions. And the more of these we can get done throughout the country, the better it is. And then you just have the entire concept of federalism, and that's something Governor Ducey has been very aggressive in, is just realizing, as he mentioned early on, he thanked Gavin Newsom repeatedly for being his chief economic development officer, because so many people are fleeing California for a more I wouldn't even say business-friendly, but worker-friendly climes, where government isn't trying to interrupt your side hustle or the career that you want to work in. So it's good to see other states jumping on board, but I definitely do see more interest in this as an issue, and I'd love to see it go more nationwide.
You know, you keep bringing up Governor Ducey, and I love the example of him helping the man who was cutting hair for the homeless, especially because it touches upon so many different facets of licensing reform. So he was actually studying to become a cosmetologist, and the cosmetology board was like, oh, you're not a full cosmetologist. If you don't stop cutting hair for the homeless, we'll never give you a license, which is a move. It's not what I would have chosen to do. And Governor Ducey said, hey, this isn't appropriate. He's, you know, trying to help people out. And there was a hit piece published about a year later, I think, on him, and it was saying, oh, well, the man trying to cut hair for the homeless had a criminal record. And Governor Ducey's like, yeah, I know, like, second chances matter. I said I'd support second chances, and guess what, I actually do. And it got to the point where, you know, it shouldn't matter if you're cutting hair after you've you know, after you've been in prison or after you've committed a crime, you know, getting back on your feet is a good thing. But it's interesting because I feel like Governor Ducey's approached licensing reform from just about every angle. One other thing he's done a lot of, too, is telehealth reform. And it gets to the point that there's a lot of different policies that are kind of around licensing reform but aren't quite licensing reform, whether it's even zoning reform in a way. You know, you have to only live in a certain kind of place if you want to, or home-based business reform where you can't always work from home, and with zoning, a lot of times you can't have mixed use in the same area, which is for some people kind of silly, or telehealth where it's not quite licensing, but it's sort of licensing because you have to live you have to be able to be licensed in the same state as a person where the person's located in order to give them telehealth services. So I'm curious, or even trade policy in a way sometimes gets into those big barriers. So I'd be curious what you think the next issue that could kind of align with this is, whether it's telehealth or zoning, or if it's kind of like an all of the above thing where it's like, hey, we've had success with showing people why licensing reform matters. Maybe next we kind of popularize zoning reform, or telehealth is really just closely tied in. What do you think is another issue that that's just really, really close to it and could kind of appeal to the same people?
Well, this is John again. I can just jump in quickly on this. Somebody who worked at the Goldwater Institute with me, Steven Slavinsky, he's now with Pacific Legal, and he's done some fantastic reports and studies on how occupational licensing reform reduces recidivism rates with people who need those second chances, as you mentioned, this guy giving haircuts to the homeless, by lowering the bar for people to get gainful employment is a very powerful way to make sure they keep on the straight and narrow. And, you know, a lot of people make mistakes, especially very early in life, and are sentenced and released. And this is a great way for folks in that transition for stepping out of prison and very quickly getting into a job where they can, you know, make an honest living for themselves. So check out those reports. I think that is an issue that's under discussed.
Yeah, Steve Slavinsky does awesome work. I've relied on a lot of his reports in the past. Scott or Colin, do you want to talk about zoning, trade, an issue that I'm missing?
Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, okay. Well, I think you nailed a couple of them, Shoshana. I think land use reform and telehealth are really two big ones that really fall into very much the same bucket. Looking at land use, you know, it really checks all the boxes about, enriching members of an exclusive club, but keeping a lot of outsiders, out, and typically those that are more disadvantaged than the club members, and then imposing all sorts of broader economic harms on physical mobility and economic growth and the rest. Telehealth, very similar. And I think telehealth really fits in more also with remote work more broadly. Let's face it, remote work has exploded during the pandemic. I was an OG remote worker going back now more than a decade. But we need to reform certain federal and state laws related to remote work that can allow that to happen more easily. Tax laws are a mess when it comes to remote work. States are trying to claw back some of those tax dollars, even though people aren't working in their states anymore. And that's, I think, another area where there's really ripe for reform along the same lines of kind of empowering workers and consumers, in ways that, improve their lives.
Yeah, I'll try to put a bow on this to a degree, which is just to kind of highlight the in vogue way of talking about these issues, which is supply side progressivism. And I think this really encapsulates all the issues we're talking about, whether it's housing supply or worker supply, which is this idea of like people on the left for a long time have subsidized demand, but we are reaching a point in which we need to increase supply. And this has been an issue for a long time, but again, going back to inflation, it's really highlighted how acute this issue is. So I think it's just, this is the new thing that people really should be focusing on is like, how can we increase the supply of things that people need every day, whether it's healthcare, whether it's hairdressers, whether it's florists, whether it's housing, whether it's this, that, and whatever. We should always be trying to find ways in which we can increase supply without necessarily harming workers, harming the quality of the goods, harming health, safety, what have you. I think it's one of the most pressing issues of our time. And I'm really glad that not only are people on the center left adopting this, but that there are allies within the libertarian movement and the center right who are also talking about this.
Yeah, we libertarian supply-siders are welcome you to the party, pals.
We're latecomers, but we're
excited. Hey, we're happy to have you. Better late than never.
I love this. This has to be one of the most friendly panels ever. But it's funny too. One thing I actually wanted to add in from Scott's story is that back, I think this is 2018 or 2019. So very, not long before the pandemic, the Goldwater Institute was highlighting this case about, I want to say it was a local Arizona town. So it's not Governor Ducey's fault, to his credit, where, they were trying to prevent a woman from working from home. So first she had a couple of colleagues working with her from home, and they're like, oh, well, you can't do that because extra cars on the street, which is like three extra cars. So she's like, okay, it's just me. And I'm taking care of, I'm taking care of a family member in need. And they're like, yeah, but you're working from home and you can't do that. And she's like, it's a desk. Like, I have a desk and a computer. Like, I don't know what you want from me. I have a phone too. I'm sorry. But the barriers they put up literally for someone to work home alone by themselves. This happened, I want to say it was Tennessee with someone uploading videos to YouTube. And then, the next year, everyone was working from home to avoid spreading the coronavirus, which is wild that just in such a short time, it went from, you can't do this, we will enforce this against you, to, oh no, if we enforce this against people, this kind of goes against other things, which shows you not just, some regulations are dumb, sure, or I might think some regulations are dumb, but they can be really consequential when you're telling someone, hey, if you work from home, you might be prosecuted, you might not, but yeah, you want to take that chance.
Yeah, and they also, Shoshana, and by the way, I think home-based business is another area that's ripe for that really much, very much falls in this kind of same bucket of, empowering workers and mobility and the rest. But I think the other really important thing is that a lot of these regulations breed sclerosis, and sclerosis that is extremely problematic in times of immense change, like during the pandemic or in our post-pandemic world. I mean, whether it's the ports or remote work or whatever, you look around and you you scratch beneath the surface of a crisis and you find all sorts of regulatory and other policies that inhibit adjustment, you know, whether it, you know, just prevent people from adjusting to an economic shock of some sort and getting on with their lives. And of course, you know, boosting the economy in the process. And so I think there's a lot of area for trying to clear out the brush that has accumulated over decades in things, you know, like zoning and the rest, that is really caused a problem for our economy in these kind of very uncertain times.
Absolutely. You know, regulations, it can cause some real bad effects. And especially even the ones that sound silly or oh, whatever, this isn't a big deal. They can still be enforced. And if they're on the books, they can be enforced. And it doesn't mean we can't have real regulations with provisions to waive them in emergencies. There's a lot of options, but we definitely can't continue to just view them in a vacuum, especially after the pandemic, after natural disasters, and now the labor shortage. We really have to think of it holistically, which I know sounds cliche, but after seeing the past few years, it's really true. So I know we're at time now, and I want to thank everyone for being able to make time for this. I want to thank the governor for joining, not just because I love Utah, but he's done some really thoughtful work out in Utah. And I'm glad we got a bunch of different perspectives, all different kinds of nerds here. And I also want to thank the Federalist Society for having me as a member since I was 16, which is longer ago than I wish to say, but I'm still that much of a nerd. And I really appreciate them being willing to focus on this issue for so long and bring people together to talk about it. So thank you everyone for joining. And I think the Federalist Society is going to be posting this on their website in the near future. So if you want to re-listen to it, my great voice, which sounds a little bit like Minnie Mouse, or the better voices of my colleagues who were able to join, you'll be able to. And if you want to send this to anyone, you'll be able to. So thank you, everyone. I really appreciate it. A little bit like Minnie Mouse, or the better voices of my colleagues who were able to join, you'll be able to. And if you want to send this to anyone, you'll be able to. So thank you, everyone. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the invitation, Shoshana. This was great.
Thank you, Shoshana.
Thanks so much, Shoshana, and Colin, and John, and Scott. That was an absolutely fantastic discussion. As Shoshana noted, this will be up as a guest at regproject.org. And to those in our audience, thank you so much for tuning in. You can throw us a follow here at FedSocRTP, or check out our website, regproject.org, to stay up to date on everything we're doing. Thanks, all.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.